Welcome to The Patriot, 1776. Hi, this is John Mady, and I am the pastor of Victory Baptist Church in North Fort Myers, Florida. And who is the Patriot of 1776? You are, and I am, and so is everyone who loves America and wants to follow the principles of our founding fathers. The last sentence of the Declaration of Independence reads like this: "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." If it had not been for the Patriots of 1776, we would still be paying taxes to England and drinking a spot of tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Help us win back America now, just like the Patriots of 1776 won America in the first place. You should take notes and use your Bible. We will give you our mailing address later. The year 1215, the Magna Carta. 1611, the King James Bible. 1769, Blackstone's Law Commentaries. 1848, the Communist Manifesto. 1815, the book, The Law. Now, these are dates and books and people that have affected the United States. And so we're looking at these, and right now we're on The Law. We're going to continue looking at The Law by Friedrich Bastiat. And his book, The Law, was written in 1850. And so just a little bit about him as we continue in this book. Friedrich Bastiat was a French economist, statesman, and author. He did most of his writing during the years just before and immediately following the Revolution of February 1848. This was the period when France was rapidly turning to complete socialism. The Law is here presented again because the same situation exists in America today as in the France of 1848. The same socialistic, communistic ideas and plans that were then adopted in France are now sweeping America. And that's why we're studying these things. We're reading from books. I'm encouraging you to buy the book that we're presenting. We're looking right now at the book called The Law by Friedrich Bastiat. And his last name is spelled B-A-S-T-I-A-T. So we started in here last week, and now we'll continue and see the things that he has to say. And we're talking about plunder. Now, plunder is to steal. That's a good way of putting it, to steal. And so what he's saying now is that plunder violates ownership. And when we talk about plunder, there are two kinds of plunder. One plunder, we all know about, that's when people steal from you. And the other plunder is when you put the word legal in front of it and you call it legal plunder. This is the kind of plunder that the government does. And as we read through the law, Friedrich Bastiat explains that just because the government is the government doesn't necessarily mean that the government does everything right. But it's our responsibility as citizens of America that we look out for this legal plunder, the things that government takes away from us and they shouldn't be. So now we're going to begin reading again and see what Friedrich has to say about this. And the title of this portion of his book is Plunder Violates Ownership. I do not, as is often done, use the word in any vague, uncertain, approximate, or metaphorical sense. I use it in its scientific acceptance, as expressing the idea opposite to that of property, wages, land, money, or whatever. When a portion of wealth is transferred from the person who owns it without his consent and without compensation, and whether by force or by fraud, to anyone who does not own it, then I say that property is violated, that an act of plunder is committed. And close quote. Now, I just want to make a mention about something. I want you to remember that these things were written in 1850. This book was written in 1850. So keep that in mind. And like it said at the beginning, you would think in reading this book that it is for us today and that it was written by someone today. And so now remembering that it was written in 1850 and it fits us exactly today because the government is taking away from us and plundering us, but because the government is doing it, it's legal plunder. If one of us were to do the same thing that the government does, then we would go to jail. But because the government does it, it becomes legal plunder because they make a law that says it's okay. All right, let's go back to the book. Quote, I say that this exact act is exactly what the law is supposed to suppress, always and everywhere. When the law itself commits this act that it is supposed to suppress, I say the plunder is still committed. And I add that from the point of view of society and welfare, this aggression against rights is even worse. In this case of legal plunder, however, the person who receives the benefits is not responsible for the act of plundering. The responsibility for this legal plunder rests with the law, the legislator, and society itself. Therein lies the political danger. It is to be regretted that the word plunder is offensive. I have tried in vain to find an inoffensive word, for I would not at any time, especially now, wish to add an irritating word to our dissensions. Thus, whether I am believed or not, I declare that I do not mean to attack the intentions or the morality of anyone. Rather, I am attacking an idea which I believe to be false, a system which appears to me to be unjust, an injustice so independent of personal intentions that each of us profits from it without wishing to do so and suffers from it without knowing the cause of the suffering. There are three systems of plunder. The sincerity of those who advocate protectionism, socialism, and communism is not here questioned. Any writer would do that must be influenced by a political spirit or a political fear. It is to be pointed out, however, that protectionism, socialism, and communism are basically the same plant in three different stages of its growth. All that can be said is that legal plunder is more visible in communism because it is complete plunder, and in protectionism, because the plunder is limited to specific groups and industries. Thus it follows that of the three systems, socialism is the vaguest, the most indecisive, and consequently the most sincere stage of development. It is a special privilege of government protection against competition, a monopoly. If it were granted only to one group in France, the iron workers, for instance, this act would be so obviously be legal plunder that it could not last for long. It is for this reason that we see all the protected trades combined into a common cause. They even organize themselves in such a way as to appear to represent all persons who labor. Instinctively, they feel that legal plunder is concealed by generalizing it, unquote. Now, just to mention something at this end, most people don't think about this, but the unions are communistic. And if the unions are used to gain communism, but if you go to communist countries, there are no unions. And so the unions are one of these things that are used, as Lenin said, useful idiots. Those things that are going on, and most of the people who are in them do not understand what they are. They do not understand how unions are used to destroy freedom, but they are. And we'll talk about that. We're going to study unions at one point. So now let's go on. Quote, but sincere or insincere, the intentions of persons are not here under question. In fact, I have already said that legal plunder is based partially on philanthropy, even though it is a false philanthropy. With this explanation, let us examine the value, the origin, and the tendency of this popular aspiration by which claims to accomplish the general welfare by general plunder. Law is force. Since the law organizes justice, the socialists ask why the law could not organize labor, education, and religion. Why should not the law be used for these purposes? Because it could not organize labor, education, and religion without destroying justice. We must remember that the law is force, and that consequently, the proper functions of the law cannot lawfully extend beyond the proper functions of force. When law and force keep a person within the bounds of justice, they impose nothing but a mere negation. They oblige him only to abstain from harming others. They violate neither his personality, his liberty, nor his property. They are a safeguard. All of these, they are defensive. They defend equally the rights of all. Then we'll go on to another part of it. And this next part that we're going to talk about, he begins with naming the paragraph, The Influence of Socialist Writers. Because we do have writers, you can study them in history and read and understand what they're saying, and you can study them even today, and you can hear them. A lot of our politicians, the Democrats, are socialists, and they're writers. Some of them are writers, but here we're talking about the history of socialist writers. So the name of the paragraph is The Influence of Socialist Writers. Quote, how do politicians ever come to believe this weird idea that the law could not be made to produce what it does not contain, the wealth, science, and religion that, in a positive sense, constitute prosperity? Is it due to the influence of our modern writers on public affairs? Present-day writers, especially those of the socialist school of thought, base their various theories upon one common hypothesis. They divide mankind into two parts, people in general, with the exception of the writer himself, form the first group. The writer, all alone, forms the second and the most important group. Surely this is the weirdest and most conceited notion that ever entered a human brain. In fact, these writers on public affairs begin by supposing that people have within themselves no means of discernment, no motivation to action. The writers assume that people are inert matter, passive particles, motionless atoms, and at best, a kind of vegetation indifferent to its own manner of existence. They assume that people are susceptible to being shaped by the will and hand of another person into an infinite variety of forms, more or less symmetrical, artistic, and perfected. Moreover, not one of these writers on governmental affairs hesitates to imagine that he himself, under the title of organizer, discoverer, legislator, or founder, is this will and hand, the universal motivating force, this creative power whose sublime mission is to mold these scattered materials, persons, into a society. These socialist writers look upon people in the same manner that the gardener views his trees. Such as the gardener capriciously shapes the trees into pyramids, parasols, cubes, vases, fans, and other forms, just so does the socialist writer whimsically shape human beings into groups, series, centers, subcenters, honeycombs, labor corps, and other variations. And just as the gardener needs axes, pruning hooks, saws, and shears to shape his trees, just so does the socialist writer need the force that he can only find in law to shape human beings. For this purpose, he devises tariffs, laws, tax laws, relief laws, and school laws. The socialists wish to play God. Socialists look upon people as raw material to be formed into socialist combinations. This is so true that if by chance the socialists have any doubts about the success of these combinations, they will demand that a small portion of mankind be set aside to experiment upon. The popular idea of trying all systems is well known, and one socialist leader has been known seriously to demand that the constituent assembly give him a small district with all its inhabitants to try his experiments upon. In the same manner, an inventor makes a model before he constructs the full-sized machine. The chemist wastes some chemicals. The farmer wastes some seeds and land to try out a new idea. But what a difference there is between the gardener and his trees, between the inventor and his machine, between the chemist and his elements, between the farmer and his seeds. And in all sincerity, the socialist thinks that there is the same difference between him and mankind. It is no wonder that the writers of the 19th century look upon society as an artificial creation of the legislator's genius. This idea, the fruit of classical education, has taken possession of all the intellectuals and famous writers of our country. The idea to these intellectuals and writers, the relationship between persons and the legislator appears to be the same as the relationship between the clay and the potter. Moreover, even where they have consented to recognize a principle of action in the heart of man and a principle of discernment in man's intellect, they have considered these gifts from God to be fatal gifts. They have thought that persons under the impulse of these two gifts would fatally tend to ruin themselves. They assume that if the legislators left persons free to follow their own inclinations, they would arrive at atheism instead of religion, ignorance instead of knowledge, poverty instead of production, and exchange. And so, I guess we can say close quotes here. And so, here we have these people who are socialists, these people who are Democrats today, because all these people that believe like what we just read, they all come in under a democracy. They want democracy because democracy leads to socialism, leads to communism. And they cannot allow people to think for themselves. That's the reason why we have public or government schools, so that they can convince the kids of group think. And so that they can also dumb down the kids, because the less education that there is, the easier it is to control people when they don't have the understanding. And so now we're going to talk in a different area of the book, and we're getting towards the end of it, the error of the socialist writers. So we'll quote again. Actually, it is not strange that during the 17th and 18th centuries, the human race was regarded as inert matter, ready to receive everything, form, face, energy, movement, life, from a great prince or a great legislator or a great genius. Close quotes. I want to explain to you the word inert. That's an important word, and although most of us might understand that, I want to just say again what the meaning of that word inert is. It means emptiness, of no value. So when they say the human race was regarded as inert matter, ready to receive everything, what it's saying is that inert matter is like clay, and it's ready to receive anything. So whatever the potter does to that clay is how that the direction that that clay goes. So that's what we're talking about. So let's go again. These centuries, quote, these centuries were nourished on the study of antiquity, on long time ago history. And antiquity presents everywhere, in Egypt, Persia, Greece, Rome, the spectacular of a few men molding mankind according to their whims, thanks to the prestige of force and of fraud. But this does not prove that this situation is desirable. It proves only that since men and society are capable of improvement, it is naturally to be expected that error, ignorance, despotism, slavery, and superstition should be greatest towards the origins of history. The writers quoted above were not in error when they found ancient institutions to be such, but they were in error when they offered them for the admiration and imitation of future generations. Uncritical and childish conformists, they took for granted the grandeur, dignity, morality, and happiness of the artificial societies of the ancient world. They did not understand that knowledge appears and grows with the passage of time, and that in proportion to this growth of knowledge, might takes the side of right, and society regains possession of itself. What is liberty? Actually, what is the political struggle that we witness? It is the instinctive struggle of all people toward liberty. And what is this liberty, whose very name makes the heart beat faster and shakes the world? It is not the union of all liberties, liberty of conscience, of education, of association, of the press, of travel, of labor, of trade. In short, is not liberty the freedom of every person to make full use of his faculties, so long as he does not harm other persons while doing so? Is not liberty the destruction of all despotism, including, of course, legal despotism? Finally, is not liberty the restricting of the law only to the rational sphere of organizing, the right of the individual to lawful self-defense, of punishing injustice? It must be admitted that the tendency of the human race toward liberty is largely thwarted, especially in France. This is greatly due to a fatal desire learned from the teachings of antiquity that our writers on public affairs have in common. They desire to set themselves above mankind in order to arrange, organize, and regulate it according to their fancy. And now what I would like to do is just to read the last paragraph, the last thing that Friedrich Bastiat says. And after going through more, and I'm skipping around the book, and so we're at the end of the book now, and you can remember what the end of the Communist Manifesto was like, and that was to cause problems throughout the world so that they could get democracy and so that they could take over the world and train those poor, ignorant people. Now here's what Friedrich Bastiat says in the law. God has given to men all that is necessary for them to accomplish their destinies. He has provided a social form as well as a human form. And these social organs of persons are so constituted that they will develop themselves harmoniously in the clean air of liberty. Away then with quacks and organizers. Away with their rings, chains, hooks, and pincers. Away with their artificial systems. Away with the whims of government. Government administrators, their socialized projects. And now that the legislators and do-gooders have so futilely inflicted so many systems upon society, may they finally end where they should have begun. May they reject all systems and try liberty, for liberty is an acknowledgement of faith in God and His works. God bless this great book, The Law. So comes the end of today's message. We appreciate so much that you spent time to be with us. If you enjoy our program, would you please take time to send us any questions you might have, along with a love offering of any amount? And if you send at least $25, we will send you a 92-page book, When Good Men Do Nothing, Who Will Speak? Our address is The Patriot, 1776, at 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Again, The Patriot, 1776. The address is 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Talk to you again next time. Goodbye now.